Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. Few people have done more to chronicle that war, and particularly to help us understand the oft-noted reality that the past is prelude, than our guest for this very special edition of Secure Freedom Radio. He is Dr. Paul Kanger, a good friend and great inspiration as a professor of political science and as the executive director of the Center for Vision and Values at a most extraordinary institution, Grove City College in my native state, the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. Paul Kanger is a best-selling author many times over, having contributed greatly to our understanding of President Ronald Reagan's history and legacy, among other things. He is the author of my personal favorite, The Judge, William P. Clark, Ronald Reagan's Top Hand, the story of a much unappreciated national security advisor for President Reagan. But he is also, most recently, the author of a brand new book. In fact, it's extraordinary that we're able to get a full hour of his time at the moment as he is out bringing it to the world's attention. It is entitled A Pope and a President, John Paul II, Ronald Reagan, and the Extraordinary Untold Story of the 20th Century. Paul Kanger, welcome back. It is so good to have you, and congratulations on the new book.
Well, thank you, Frank. It's always great to be with you, and I should start by connecting those two books. I actually dedicate this book to Bill Clark, and if it wasn't for Bill Clark, this book would have never happened, and I could proceed to explain why.
Yeah, well, let's just start there, because there is an extraordinary story here, and it did do much to shape the 20th century. So give us a flavor of what you found and my friend Bill Clark's role in it.
Well, I guess the way it really happened, I started filing FOIA requests, you know, Freedom of Information Act requests, back in 2000. At the Reagan Library on anything that had to deal with Ronald Reagan, John Paul II, Poland. But a little bit after that, I was working on the biography of Bill Clark, and we were sitting in his den, his living room at his ranch house in Shandon, California, near Paso Robles, California. And this would have been summer of 2005. And by that point, Frank, I mean, Bill and I had talked about everything under the sun. I mean, you just can't even begin to imagine. I mean, you knew Bill Clark. You know what he was like. And he would call me every day when I wasn't at the ranch. And one day we were just sort of going over things. And I said to him, I said, "Hey, Bill, I don't think I've ever asked you this. What did you and Ronald Reagan know about the shooting of the Pope?" And he looked at me, and with the things he started to say, I didn't even think to push the record button on my recorder. I was so transfixed by it. And I stopped and started writing as quickly as I could. But what he told me, Frank, in brief, is that he and Bill Casey at the CIA, you know, used the word intelligence briefing in the introduction to your show. I mean, talk about intelligence briefings, right? Casey was the master of it. He told me that he, Bill Clark, Bill Casey at the CIA, and Ronald Reagan, from the beginning, suspected that the Soviets were involved in the shooting of John Paul II. And he told me that I wanted to include this in our book, in our biography. And I said, "Bill, this is extraordinary. I mean, nobody knows about this." I immediately put one of my student researchers on this task. I said, I was way out in the desert, right, in the Paso Robles, and I called her up. I said, "Rachel, could you do a quick search and find any examples in the public papers of the presidents of Reagan addressing the shooting of the Pope. And she came back with four or five examples, Frank, I had never seen before. These were all press conferences, but every single time Reagan dodged the question. And so I told Bill, I said, look at these. I've got these. I think she emailed them to the office. We got them in town a couple days later. And I said, well, it looks like Reagan dodged it. He said, yeah, of course he dodged it because he didn't know the answer. And I saw there, and you'll appreciate this, Frank. I mean, you know, the left always portrayed Reagan as this verbal bomb thrower. But he called the Soviet Union an evil empire when he needed to, when he felt that he had to, when it would work, when it would serve a beneficial purpose. But he didn't shoot from the hip or the lip. He wasn't careless and reckless. So when the press asked him, do you think the Soviets were behind the shooting of the Pope? He said, well, the short answer is, I don't know. The Italians are looking into it. They're considering it. We support them in their investigative efforts. But privately, Frank, he thought all along.
Well, let's back the lens up, Paul, because this is a tantalizing insight into, as you say, of the greatest story of the 20th century, arguably, certainly one of the most strategically consequential. Remind us of the relationship between Ronald Reagan, not a Catholic, and the Pope, John Paul II, and what they were about at that time.
Yeah, and I'll back it up even a little bit more. I would say the relationship started, in a way, kind of long distance, in June of 1979. And that was when John Paul II made his 9-day trip to Poland. And I go through, among other things, we now have declassified from the Matrokhin archives and other sources, Brezhnev's call to Edward Gierek, the communist leader of Poland, and Brezhnev telling him, you know, you tell the Pope he can't come. And Gierek says, well, I can't tell him he can't come. How am I going to do that? And Brezhnev bawled him out and said, Gomulka was a better communist than you, and slammed down the phone. But John Paul II came anyway. And, you know, literally millions came out to see this. And one person who saw it from long distance was Ronald Reagan, who was watching on his TV set in California. And a mutual friend of ours, Dick Allen, Richard V. Allen, who had become the first national security advisor to Reagan before Bill Clark at the NSC, Allen was sitting there with Reagan watching footage at the time. And Allen said he looked over at Reagan, and tears were in his eyes as he watched these massive crowds turning out for this Polish Pope. And Allen said that Reagan said then and there, that's it, that's it, that's it. The Pope is the key. The Pope is the key. And he said, Dick, we got to basically get elected, and then we got to reach out to the Pope and the Vatican and make them an ally.
Hold this thought, because this is what I really want to drill down with you on. You've delved deeply into Reagan's life, including his spiritual life, the subtitle of your book, God and Ronald Reagan. He was not a Catholic himself. I know, of course, Bill Clark was, Bill Casey was, others I suspect around him were. But what was going on here wasn't just a sort of connection at a spiritual level, was it? It was a strategic insight into the role of the Pope and his relationship to the enslaved peoples of not just Poland, but throughout the Soviet Empire.
Well, that's right. And think about this too, Frank. We're dealing with the Holy Father, as he's called, in the Catholic Church, and Ronald Reagan's own father was Catholic. Ronald Reagan's brother was Catholic. So he grew up around Catholics. So he was completely comfortable with them. He knew their language, knew the liturgies, knew, was familiar with the sacraments, even the sacramentals and all the different things that went on in the Catholic Church. In fact, Bill Clark used to tell me that Ronald Reagan understood Catholicism better than most Catholics that Bill knew, which is probably true. But when he saw this Pope go to Poland, and I love this, the opening homily of his opening mass for the visit to Poland was held in Victory Square in Warsaw. Don't you love that? Victory Square. And he said there, he combined spirituality and politics as well. He said, Christ cannot be kept out of the history of man in any part of the globe. in any longitude or latitude of geography. And then he made this stunning statement, which was a shot heard around the world, especially in Moscow. The Pope said, "There can be no just Europe without the independence of Poland marked on its map."
Wow. We're going to pause for just a second. Paul Kinger is our guest. Much more on this fascinating story of a Pope and a president straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. Our guest is Dr. Paul Kinger, best-selling author many times over, and most recently, a book that I'm quite certain is headed to the top of the lists again, A Pope and a President, John Paul II, Ronald Reagan, and the Extraordinary Untold Story of the 20th Century. And Paul, you were just perfectly setting us up for a further discussion of this. The Pope made clear in his opening homily, in his first mass in Victory Square during this extraordinary operation behind enemy lines, really, that he was there to put Poland on the map, a free Poland on the map. Tell us what he had in mind and how he and Ronald Reagan helped bring that about.
Yeah, so his goal is nothing short of the literal liberation of Poland, and, you know, not just spiritually but politically as well. And that was actually Reagan's goal too. And at the time, so June 1979, Frank, Reagan doesn't yet have his bully pulpit of the presidency, but the great communicator actually had a daily syndicated radio broadcast, which was heard on literally thousands of stations. Reagan loved that medium, and he immediately jumped on that offer to have this broadcast. People don't know how influential that was. I mean, millions of people actually heard Reagan daily in these short syndicated commentaries. And Reagan went right into the studio and did a series of broadcasts on the Pope's trip to Poland.
And let me just ask you very quickly, Paul, who wrote those?
Yeah, Ronald Reagan himself wrote them, every single one of them.
The so-called amiable dunce actually was a brilliant writer and, as you say, communicator. So,
yeah, these are basically like short op-ed pieces, 300 to 500 words. And if he had to go longer, then he'd do a Poland Part 1, a Poland Part 2, a Poland Part 3. And that's what he did with these. And one of them, he said that Stalin once contemptuously asked, "How many divisions does the Pope have?" And Reagan said, "Well, we just got an answer." He said, "Wherever the Pope went in Poland, you know, 400,000 came out, 500,000, 1 million, and then 5
Many
million.
Divisions and enough to liberate a country. This is one of the most interesting of Stalin's many quips. And indeed, as you say, Paul, when he talked about contemptuously, let's recall, in World War II, how many divisions does the Pope have? The Pope didn't have any, and frankly, wasn't at that time, I guess, much of a leader either. But this Pope, John Paul II, was totally different in that regard as in so many others. And when Reagan saw the Pope speaking in this fashion in 1979 and began talking it up in the United States, he was obviously talking not just to Catholics, but he was talking to many Americans. And if you would, Paul, describe the context here, the coming challenge he would represent to Jimmy Carter, who had a very different view of the Soviet Union at the time, didn't he?
Oh, he sure did. And Reagan said in that broadcast, he said, "Will the Kremlin ever be the same again? Will any of us, for that matter?" And, you know, Reagan was never the same again. And at the same time, he's watching Jimmy Carter, who was truly accommodating Tito in Yugoslavia. No one will remember this. You probably will, Frank. Jimmy Carter arranged for the crown of St. Stephen to be given back to the Hungarian communist leadership, which was an outrage. This was a big deal at the time. Bob Dole in the Senate at the time went all the way to the Supreme Court to try to see if he could get the Supreme Court to intervene in stopping that. Carter made a scandalous trip to Poland where he said, you know, just pardon me, but the stupidest, most outrageous things about the people of Poland enjoying religious freedom, even talking to Karol Wojtyła's senior, Cardinal Wyszyński, about how nice it is, the religious freedom that you folks enjoy here. And Wyszyński looked at him like he'd lost his mind.
A lot of us looked at Jimmy Carter as though he'd lost his mind, I have to confess.
Oh. It's amazing. It's just an amazing thing. But Reagan thought just the opposite. He said, no, no, no. These people of Poland have been denied God. And now somebody is coming there telling them, no, 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 you need God. You have God, and no one's going to stop you from getting God. And Reagan said, well, to further ensure that, we need to do what the Pope wants to do. We need to ensure the independence of Poland on the map. But it was much more than that. They both believed that if they could free Poland, that Poland could be the dagger to the heart of the Soviet Empire. If you could free Poland, you could start to free the rest of the communist bloc. I think neither one of them probably thought the dominoes would fall as quickly as they did.
But they had a vision, a shared vision. So, Paul, I personally believe that what Reagan did to get a mandate from the American people in the run-up to that 1980 election was critical to everything that flowed from it. And what you've just described is a seminal moment in his political project to create the expectation and to offer the American people the leadership that would be required to fulfill it, to destroy the Soviet Union. When you look back on it and you understand, as you do, from sort of this ringside seat, is there any question that that project that the president embarked upon was really inspired by this moment of the Pope in Poland?
Oh, yeah, it absolutely was. And Bill Clark told me, he said, Reagan knew Poland would be the linchpin in the dissolution of the Soviet Empire. And Clark told me that Reagan realized that as early as June 1979. And he said this might be taking it back a little bit too far. He said, but he realized that, you know, with Yalta, the injustice at Yalta, which was February 1945, Reagan talked about the martyred nation of Poland, as he called it. Now think about that. Here's this Protestant president talking about the martyred nation of Poland in almost like John Paul II sort of language. So you know, he had this kinship with the Polish people dating all the way back to the 1940s. And so imagine October 16th, 1978, the conclave, the College of Cardinals, picks the first non-Italian pope in 455 years. The first Slavic pope ever, and they pluck him out of the middle of the heart of the Soviet Empire, Poland. And so Reagan, a non-Catholic, saw this as providence, as providential. So, you know, all he needed to do now, no small charge, right? All he needed now was to win the presidency to pull that linchpin with a Polish partner in the Vatican.
So let me ask you quickly, Paul Kinger, as a world-class historian, looking back on this time, how important do you think it was to Ronald Reagan actually becoming president of the United States that he was able to articulate that vision, notably with his famous expression, "We win, they lose," to describe his strategy, in securing the dramatic majority that he won over Jimmy Carter in the 1980 election?
Oh, I think it was very important, Frank. And I mean, look, Americans by that point were sick of detente, which had come to them not just from Carter, but Gerald Ford and Richard Nixon. In a way, they kind of tried it, right? And then by 1980, after seeing the Soviets march into Afghanistan, and that was, what, maybe 6 months after Jimmy Carter and Leonid Brezhnev literally smooched each other at the Vienna summit. And after, boy, at that point, the Iranian hostage crisis, the Soviets had picked up 10, 11, 12 different satellites around the world from 1974 to 79. We lost Nicaragua to the communists.
And invaded Afghanistan, which shook even Jimmy Carter from his appeasement strategy. But we have to pause for a moment, Paul Kinger. When we come back, I want to jump forward to the Reagan presidency and how the Pope and he actually freed Poland right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. Our guest is Dr. Paul Kenger, who is very generously giving us, on the week of his rollout of his brand new book, a full hour of his time to discuss a pope and a president, John Paul II, Ronald Reagan, and the extraordinary untold story of the 20th century. So, Paul, we've been visiting about parts of that untold story and how you learned of it from our mutual friend Bill Clark. You can get us, I hope, quickly into the Reagan presidency and how, in the run-up to the assassination of or attempted assassination of John Paul II, they were beginning to actually operationalize this idea, and then something very bad happened.
Well, that's right, Frank. They immediately started trying to meet, and one of the documents that I found that I put in the book is Reagan sending a letter to Pio Laghi, who became the apostolic nuncio in Washington, in December 1980. Reagan was at Blair House. He wasn't even in the White House yet, and he fires off this letter congratulating Laghi. And Laghi got it, and Laghi said, "Wow, look at this. President-elect Reagan even knows who I am?" And he sent him this letter, but that was a sign of how eager Reagan was to get together. So they started reaching out immediately. Moscow immediately feared a Reagan-Pope alliance. And I found this piece in the Soviet press. This is February 1981. And Frank, this kind of language won't surprise you because you knew what just incendiary nuts the Soviets were. But the Soviet press denounced John Paul II as a, quote, malicious, lowly, perfidious, backward toady of American militarists. And isn't that nice? And they said that he is seeking to undermine communism with his overseas accomplices, and get this, and with his new boss in the White House. So they're referring to Reagan as John Paul II's new boss. Imagine that. So of all things, you know, the Kremlin no doubt is literally hoping that these guys would be dead, right? Stalin, you know, death solves all problems. No man, no problem. And they almost got their wish. March 30th, 1981, in the Washington Hilton, outside the Washington Hilton, Reagan walking outside, John Hinckley pulls out a gun and shoots him. Reagan almost bled to death. And then 6 weeks later, and I should add, after John Paul II immediately sends off a cable to Washington telling Reagan he's praying for him, praying for his recovery. And then a few weeks later, May 13th, 1981, Mehmet Ali Asha, a Muslim Turk, standing in St. Peter's Square, and he holds up his 9mm semi-automatic Browning and fires four shots. Two of them hit the Pope. He went down. He very, very nearly bled to death, just like Reagan did. Reagan is horrified, immediately calls Cardinals Cook and Kroll in New York and Philadelphia, sends off a cable to Rome, wishing the Pope best recovery, saying he's praying for him. And with that, Moscow had feared a Reagan-Pope alliance. Well, now they better really fear one, because these two men literally believed, and they finally got together in June 1982 after martial law declared in Poland in the intervening time, December 13th, 1981. They finally got together at the Vatican in June 1982. Bill Clark was there, and they said to one another, this Protestant president, this obviously Catholic pope, that they believed that God had intervened to spare their lives for the purpose of working together to defeat Soviet communism, and specifically by starting in Poland as the dagger in the heart of the Soviet Empire.
It is truly a great story, and you've captured it magnificently in your new book, A Pope and a President, Paul Kenger. Talk a little bit, if you would, Paul. We've visited about this in the past, but I think the context here is so important. Shortly thereafter, Ronald Reagan began enunciating in a series of national security decision directives. He directed that we start implementing the strategy to destroy the Soviet Union. I'm particularly partial to NSDD 75, which laid that out so clearly. But describe, you know, what he was doing and the fact that this it was, as the Soviets are fond of saying, no accident, comrade, that the Soviet Union did come down, that that dagger did its job. Talk about that.
Well, that's right. And yeah, and NSDD 75, that was in January 1983. And an equally important one prior to that was NSDD 32. And that was in May 1982. And I point that one out, Frank, because that was literally just weeks before Reagan went to Rome and met with John Paul II. And here's something equally interesting if you reflect on the timeline. The day after Reagan and the Pope met in Rome, Reagan flew up the continent and met with Margaret Thatcher, and that's where he gave his Westminster speech, talking about predicting that communism would end up on the ash heap of history. So isn't it really fascinating? You know, you and I remember all those moments and remember those kind of key markers, but when you see them in the actual timeline, you got NSDD 32, May, I think it was May 20th, 1982, and then Reagan in Rome, June 6th, and then the next day, June 7th at Westminster, he lays out that vision. And he also said, it's very important, he didn't just predict that it would end up in the ash heap of history. He called for a, quote, policy and plan that would place communism on the ash heap of history. And that's exactly what he and Bill Clark and the others did. They didn't just predict it. They laid out, they operationalized, as you put it, right? They sought to actually lay out a strategy that would lead to placing the Soviet Union on the ash heap of history.
And Paul, the thing that I have always valued about your historical works, of which there are too many to name, is that you understand how these historical events, these past moments and leaders can inform our own time. And one thing that I would like to just talk a little bit about is the essence of that strategy, which I've always thought of as kind of all instruments of national power brought to bear to achieve a very challenging but hugely momentous outcome, namely, you know, they lose the end of the Soviet Empire. Give us a flavor of how all of those instrumentalities were brought to bear.
Well, in the 1980s, they and I'll quote Pio Laghi on this, who was also there in Rome for that first time that they met together. And this is an astonishing quote, Frank, and people really sink their teeth into this. Laghi put it this way: nobody believed the collapse of communism would happen this fast or on this timetable, but in their first meeting, the Holy Father and President committed themselves and the institutions of the Church in America to such a goal. And from that day, the focus was to bring it about. So here you have a very clear vision, a very clear commitment, and then bringing the two sides together around the two leaders, the two guys at the top who get the big picture, and then the guys around them put together the plan, Bill Clark, others at the NSC, Roger Robinson, Ken DeGraffenried, friends of ours, John Linchowski, Sven Kramer, Herb Meyer, the CIA, it's right, all of those guys, the sort of smaller junior people, the real foot soldiers, the real heroes who did the work and wrote the documents. And you know, Reagan told the Pope, he said, hope remains in Poland and we working together can keep it alive. So how do you translate that vision into actual practical policy? Well, that's where the other guys came in, and they looked for 1,000 or, okay, put it this way, at least a couple dozen different ways to slice and dice and cut the Soviet Empire through Lech Walesa, through the Solidarity Movement, through getting fax machines into Poland, through getting, you know, money underground to the Solidarity Movement, to getting aid to the Mujahideen in Afghanistan to fight the Soviets. So you look for every SDI.
Economic warfare, political warfare, intelligence operations. Yeah. No, this is the story that I'm so grateful to you for telling now in several different books, Paul Kinger. We're going to come back with more on a Pope and a President and the lessons for our time with the author, Dr. Paul Kenger of Grove City College. Stay tuned for some of the most important insights into what we do now from Dr. Kenger and more straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. We're visiting for this full hour with Dr. Paul Kenger, one of our country's, indeed one of the world's great historians, the author of a dozen or so books, including one we've discussed already a little bit, my personal favorite of his, The Judge, William P. Clark, Ronald Reagan's Top Hand, and his most recent book, just hot off the presses, in fact, A Pope and a President, John Paul II, Ronald Reagan, and the Extraordinary Untold Story of the 20th Century. Paul, I am always reminded, in fact, it kind of is a personal leitmotif for me, of President Reagan's injunction, I think first uttered decades before he became president, when he described the fact that, as he put it, quote, every generation faces an existential threat to freedom, unquote. And he went on to talk about what you need to do about it. You know, it isn't just going to be possible for freedom to be passed on to the next generation without effort. What I'm interested in particular, is insights that you have about how he rose to that challenge, how he operationalized that injunction during his own time, and how it could be informing, should be, must be, I would argue, informing our own times' challenge, existential threat to freedom, which I think of as Sharia supremacism.
Yeah, well, the key with Reagan, Frank, as you know, is he really had he had principles, he had vision, he had a broader ideology. So he really understood all of this at a much deeper level. You know, his anti-communism wasn't just something that he came upon in 1978, 1979, or that hit him suddenly, you know, 1982, 83 in his presidency. I mean, he learned this back in Hollywood. You know, he learned this as a progressive liberal. He called himself a hemophiliac liberal, a bleeding heart liberal, who had been duped by communists, right? And you know, he used to say, you know, I'm not worried about Reykjavik. I still have scars on my back from communists knifing me in the back in Hollywood. You know, from communists telling him, "Hey, Ron, we're progressives, just like you, buddy." And then he goes in and he finds out that John Howard Lawson, Dalton Trumbo, and all these guys are closet members of Communist Party USA.
Right, and working to take down the country through the culture.
Yeah, through the culture, through the film industry. And so Reagan, you know, that slowly pulled him out of the left and then eventually towards the Republican Party, anti-communism. So I mean, think about it.
Could I just interrupt you for a second on that? Because one of the most extraordinary things was, Paul, as you know, that Ronald Reagan actually went public with what he had discovered. He broke with Hollywood as the president of the Screen Actors Guild, no less, testified before Congress in the interest of protecting his country against the enemies within. I mean, it's a moment of a real profile in courage, I think.
That's right. That was October 1947, and there were Gary Cooper and some other people in Hollywood who testified as well. But everybody agreed that Reagan, kind of young Reagan, he had been 36 years old at that point, he stole the show. He gave this really informed, impressive statement. And one of the things he said is that if it can be proven that these communists in Hollywood are in fact dedicated to a foreign government, in other words, if they really literally sworn a loyalty oath to the Soviet Union, he said, well, you know, that's another issue altogether. It's not like they're just practicing another ideology. I mean, this is kind of a homegrown, you know, the fifth column within.
Yeah, it's called treason.
Let's put a fine point on it. That all applies to what we're looking at today, doesn't it?
It does,
right?
Indeed.
You know,
Yeah, the enemies within.
Threats are today. Yeah, the enemies within. So that develops, germinates in Reagan through the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s. So he comes in 1981. He knew exactly what he wanted to do. So one of the reasons why he was so excited about having a pope who knew exactly what he wanted to do, who had Margaret Thatcher. I mean, if you talk about Providence, right? Margaret Thatcher came in 1979. So it's all perfect. If he had come in 1976, the timing would have been right. It was better that he won in 1980. You know, Gorbachev, for all of his flaws, if Reagan would have come in 76, he would have been out by 84. Gorbachev came in 85. So, you know, at least you had, as Reagan put it, a very different leader. Gorbachev wasn't Andropov. So, but you know, I'm kind of getting away from your question, but as it applies to today, Frank, yeah. So I think what we need is we need a leader in the White House who does have that larger vision, that broader vision, who does understand the threat. And Donald Trump, I think, clearly understands the threat of radical Islam and terrorism in the country. What I hope he has, I don't know that he does. I think some of the national security staff around him has this, at least hopefully, is a broader policy vision for how to deal with this. That's what's needed from the White House right now.
Well, from your lips to God's ears, I have to tell you that I am concerned about some of the people in the White House who, and most especially in the National Security Council, who seemingly, well, frankly, some of them are simply holdovers from the Obama administration. And we know they got this existential threat to freedom completely wrong. And there seem to be others who are also prominent in this administration who aren't getting it right. And I do want to say, and I know you've written somewhat critically about Donald Trump, he had nothing like the background of President Reagan or had disciplined himself to study these things as Ronald Reagan did. And having played a bit role myself in the Reagan administration in the implementation of this takedown strategy, I can only say how extraordinary it was to have somebody in the commander-in-chief's role who really understood what he was about and was able to bring others along behind him. But Donald Trump, with all of that having been said, back in August of 2016 in Youngstown, Ohio, the 15th of August, made a very, well, I would call it Reagan-esque speech, really, where he talked about, well, these are my words, victory over jihad, but he laid out the specific threats that we were facing from these various Sharia supremacists, whether it was Iran or the Islamic State or people who were trying to bring Sharia into this country, anti-constitutional agenda as it was, and not least, Paul Kenger, the networks, as he put it, that were in the business of radicalizing within the Muslim community inside the United States, the Muslim Brotherhood. So in a way, he laid out a strategy that was very much, I think, of a piece with at least the broad goals of NSDD 75 and 36 and so on. He was seeking to defeat unmistakably the existential threat of our time, and he was seeking a mandate from the American people to do it. I think he got it, and now it falls to all of us to help him execute upon it. Would you agree with any of that?
Yeah, I agree that he understands the threat, and that's huge, right? I mean, that's certainly much better than what we had the previous 8 years.
Or longer, to be honest.
Yeah, right. That's right. So the key is going to be the larger vision and the policy response. And so we had that with Reagan. I don't know if we'll have that with Trump or not. I hope we will. And the one thing that's always concerned me about Trump all along is if he's done the sort of, and I don't want to sound like a snob here, but if he's done the intellectual heavy lifting, right? If he understands the bigger picture, if he understands the broader ideology at work. I mean, Ronald Reagan read Whitaker Chambers on Witness. He read National Review. He read James Burnham. He read Frank Meyer. He read all these
And as importantly, he wrote on these subjects as well. He did that intellectual heavy lifting like you do, Paul Kenger, of actually having to distill things down. Paul, we have to pause for one last break. We'll be right back with more to talk about the needs of our time for countering this existential threat to freedom, and what we all must do to help our president achieve the greatness that Ronald Reagan did in defeating the last one. That and much more, straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back for our concluding segment of this very special edition. And when I say very special, I mean very special edition of Secure Freedom Radio with one of the most thoughtful scholars, teachers, authors on the great dynamics of history. He is Dr. Paul Kenger. We're discussing now at length his newest book, A Pope and a President, John Paul II, Ronald Reagan, and the Extraordinary Untold Story of the 20th Century. And Paul, I want to bring this up to the moment because when you look at this incredible, perfect storm for the Soviet Union, you've mentioned Margaret Thatcher, of course, John Paul II and Ronald Reagan. As we look around the world stage at the moment, let's just talk a little bit about the current Pope, Francis, the role that he's playing. Is there any similarity between the incumbent Pope and his distinguished predecessor during Reagan's era?
Well, they're definitely very different. And I mean, certainly in terms of the, you know, John Paul II's, John Paul II absolutely hated communism. And I'm not going to say that Pope Francis likes it, but he definitely doesn't have the sort of ingrained antipathy for against communism that John Paul II had and was raised with. I mean, just consider the very different places where they were raised, right? Argentina, which is very left wing, versus Poland under communism. But I think really even the more important similarity dissimilarity, Frank, if you just look at, like, put it this way, can you imagine Trump and Pope Francis coming together in the way that Reagan and John Paul II did? I can't.
Well, we saw a coming together of Pope Francis with Barack Obama for disastrous results. But Paul Kenger, I think as kind of a liberation theologian, John Paul, his successor, Pope Francis, has none of the instincts and is, if anything, playing for the other team in this existential threat to freedom. And most recently, we saw it in Egypt and in many of his speeches, confusing people about the nature of the Islamists that are threatening Western civilization, Christians by the hundreds of thousands, if not more, and the rest of us, for that matter. So we don't have this kind of partnership. The Margaret Thatcher equivalent isn't in evidence at the moment in Britain or any place else in Europe, I would argue. Donald Trump doesn't have the background that we would wish he had. He's gotten some people around him who don't get it, whereas Reagan was surrounded by people who definitely did. What, if anything, can we take from Reagan's admonition about every generation confronting existential threats to freedom to enlist the American people to play the kind of role that is all the more needed? I mean, they played to some extent during Reagan's era, no question about it, under his leadership, but that's needed now in the face of this less happy correlation of forces.
Well, it's a good question, Frank, and frankly, I'm not very optimistic about it. I mean, look, Reagan had so brought along the American people. I mean, we talked about him defeating Jimmy Carter in 1980. I think you said the word landslide. He beat Carter 51-41%, and he won 44 out of 50 states, and that's against an incumbent. And then when he got reelected in 1984, so this is really, really bringing along people, he brought people along with his anti-communist vision. He won 49 out of 50 states in 1984. He won the Electoral College 525-13. So I don't see Trump doing that. Of course, how can I say that, right? It's 4 years away. But right now, I don't see that. I mean, I certainly hope that in 4 years from now, if he's running against an Elizabeth Warren, that he wins. But he's got a lot more to do than Ronald Reagan did. And also, to bring this back to what you mentioned about the popes, so if Donald Trump's big international threat is radical Islam, he's not going to get this pope to work with him on that in the way that Reagan, seeing the big international threat being communism, got that pope to work with him.
No, that's
clear. So in
that's
many
clear.
Ways, this is a totally different ballgame.
But it places a premium on the American people's support. And I think to your very important insight, Trump needs to bring them along. I think he did during the election, but he needs to build on that, and that in part requires clarity on his own part and leadership. And Paul, up against him, of course, is not only the external enemies of, the Irans and the Islamic States and Al-Qaeda's and so on, but the internal enemies of the Muslim Brotherhood. But what makes this particularly worrying to me, and I think to you too, if I look at your collected works about, for example, the communist Frank Marshall Davis and the untold story of Barack Obama's mentor, your book about dupes, how America's adversaries have manipulated progressives for a century, your book about takedown concerning the communists, the progressives, and so on. I mean, these are all essentially insights into the role that the left has played in attacking and undermining our country, our Constitution, and making common cause, not obviously in every case, but in a number of important cases and more at the moment, in a kind of red-green axis with these Islamists. Talk a little bit about that before we wrap up.
Yeah, and they never go away, do they? I mean, you know, we're seeing in the first weeks of the Trump presidency, the Women's March, the Science March, May Day March, one after another. And I've had friends younger than us, Frank, saying, you know, I've never seen anything like this. Well, in the 1980s, they got together about 500,000 people to march in Central Park. Right? I mean, the nuclear freeze movement was unbelievable.
Yeah, and the effort to block the INF deployments of intermediate range missiles. I mean, there was a lot of that in the street stuff, no question about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, Reagan prevailed over it. He prevailed over it, you know, evil empire speech, SDI speech, by going to, you know, the great communicator, going to television and making his case. So, what Trump faces isn't anything new. You add the radical Islamist element, it is, although that was emerging under Reagan, right? Beirut, October 1983.
Well, indeed, and I think the communists were helping to promote it, which is something that even now we see being done to a fairly well. But Paul, as you look at those forces, the trends towards an ever greater radicalization of this leftist cohort and their common cause with people who, I mean, it's incredible, would kill them if they had their way. Particularly the feminists among them, the homosexuals among them, the Jews among them, the other religious
minorities. Maybe the first ones
so,
up against the wall.
First one put to the knife, you bet. So as you look at this in sort of a closing call to the president and call to the American people, informed by your masterwork, Pope and a President, how important is it that we understand this existential threat to freedom is upon us and respond appropriately, as Reagan did in his time?
Well, it's critically important. And I'm really not totally sure, Frank, how to go about educating people toward it other than things like your show, you know, the work that you've been doing at your center for years. I think all we can really do is, okay, three words, educate, educate, educate. And I think maybe the lesson from the 1980s shows that there needs to be a sort of macro education. And Reagan got this, where if you really got a leader at the top who gets it and can use the bully pulpit of the White House to push it, then you can really make great strides.
Well, that's our job, it seems to me, as both here at Secure Freedom Radio, and thank you for the compliment, Paul Kinger, and certainly yours in terms of the education you've been providing. My friend, thank you for this hour and for all that you've done with and for us over the years. I know you'll keep it up, and we look forward to continuing our conversation in the near future. We look forward to talking to the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.